Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is my good friend and mastering engineer, Stephen Markison.
Hey, Bob.
Now, you've worked with literally a who's who of the music business. Everybody from the Stones to Tom Petty to Stevie Wonder. I go on, and then you're mentioning a new act you think is going to blow up Ben Platt. Anybody else you want to throw in for my audience?
Maybe as we go along, I'll
Well, I know there's REM. There's literally too many to mention. Let's start from the beginning. What exactly is mastering?
You know, mastering is it's this gray art that people don't really understand.
Do you understand it?
I hope so. 40 years in, right. I think I got it. But it's your last creative stage of making a record. It's a chance to take all of your work and put it together in a cohesive manner. You can change the sound, you can change tempos of tracks, you can enhance centers for vocals, you can do any number of things to get a consistent sound that flows from beginning to end. There are various tools you use, whether it's you can play it back on tube-type tape machines if you're fortunate enough to see things like that. Files come in mainly these days, but occasionally we see tape. So you pick and choose how you look at a project, or I shouldn't say you, I should say I. And I put it up, I listen to it just as it comes in, and I think about what would do what I could do to enhance this project and make it deliverable to, you know, a mass, I should say, numbers of ways to play it, whether it's radio, whether you're listening to a CD, whether you're listening to high-res files, MFITs. So it's...
I don't know what MFITs are.
MFITs are mastered for iTunes.
Oh, okay. I didn't know there was an acronym on that.
There is, and it's interesting because MFIT, they tried to set a standard of quality to reduce what they call intersample overs. And
Whoa, let's slow down again. What are intersample overs?
I'm not going to get into intersample
overs. No, I want to get into a little bit.
Well, when you're working in a digital scale, there's zero. Within the scale, you can have these intersample overs, which are these spurious peaks that essentially can clip. They don't, but they can. So Apple decided to try to enhance their format, the AAC, and badge it MFIT, and it gives the mastering house, or Apple gives the mastering house, an applet to drop it on. You can measure your intersample overs, and they don't really want to see hundreds of thousands, which you can on a hot rock record. They want to see it brought down and contained within a reasonable amount. They don't define a number. They just want you to use good judgment. So an MFIT can typically be as much as a dB quieter than a CD or a digital file source. So,
okay, let's just stay with there. If you're mastering for iTunes, that's a downloadable track. Do they want the same track for the Apple Music service?
That's a very good question. And the answer is yes. I'm going through something right now because all of these services are looking at different features. Apple has the Complete My Album feature. Spotify wants it to mirror the CD. And I literally got the email a half hour ago, so I'm going to start dissecting it when I'm done here. But they want to have a standard that is consistent with their platform.
Okay, just going for left field for 1 second. Prior to these streaming services, there were the loudness wars, which we'll get back to. But now, since these... I know they basically, I don't know the technical term off the top of my head, they basically average the sound, so everything's the same volume.
Normalize,
thank you. And does that affect the loudness wars?
It does. It's loudness is measured on a LUFS scale, L-U-F-S. And depending on who's releasing or playing your file, they like to target a certain number. The lower the number, 4.3 is louder than 7.2. Our testing has shown that if you bring a CD level down a few dBs, and a few dBs is a lot. Remember, 6 dBs is twice the volume. So if you bring it down 3 dBs, their normalizer isn't kicking in as much, and consequently, your program sounds better. There's, an example that comes to mind is there's a piano vocal track that gets played up against, a slamming hard rock track. Well, the hard rock track's got stacked guitars, it's got bass, it's got bombastic drums, yet the piano and vocal is so much louder because it isn't as loud physically in the digital medium as the slamming track. So the normalizer doesn't kick in. Normalizers can really bring your level down, a lot of dBs.
So in addition, getting technical for a second, if its normalizer brings it down, obviously it's going to be quieter. How does that affect the sound?
It's not beneficial.
Let's go back to the beginning of our discussion. Theoretically, especially in today's DIY world, could you just make a record on your laptop and send it straight to a streaming service?
People do every day. That's very common. SoundCloud, people that post their music up on services like that. It's a complete DIY in many cases. They get a little action, then they want to actually master it or finish it, remix it, depending. Also, it just depends on the kind of action they get. So I think a lot of people that are, breaking in, as it were, go ahead, DIY it. If there's notice, they then maybe get noticed by a professional, an indie, somebody that wants to, join forces with them, and then they'll go rework the project.
Okay. Asking something that's not quantifiable in a quantifiable way, what percent can mastering affect a track?
Yeah, that's kind of an impossible question,
right?
But I'll attempt to answer it. If you've got a track that comes in and you were working in a studio or just in your own studio and your speakers weren't giving you reality. Reality means the balance of frequencies, lows, mids, highs were, terribly skewed. You take your track to a professional mastering facility. You're in a room that your engineers worked in for a period of time, in my case, 12 years in my particular studio. I know the room like the back of my hand. I put your track up and I say, this is dull, or this is boomy, or whatever the correction needs to be. You take my judgment, because you've now come to me for my services, and I say, well, we can open it up and the vocal now is coming out of the track and clean and clear and the bass isn't muddy and, woofing out your bottom end. So that really is a big change and well worth doing.
Okay. So since I've known you almost 40 years, you were working Precision. Then you worked at A&M before you established your own facility.
I didn't really work at A&M. A&M.
Yeah, I meant to say work in a general term. That's okay. Where your work transpired. You did not
right.
work for A&M. You rented the space.
Correct.
But my question is, all three rooms are different. Is someone like you so professional, how long does it take you to adjust to a different room?
Mastering engineers are nervous types. To make a shift in just your chain, and your chain is your processing, to plug in a new piece of gear can be daunting because it could change something. And, back to the gray area of mastering, if you put something in that you think sounds good, and I can be fooled, anybody can be fooled by sound. It's sound is an elusive dragon. But you put something in your chain and you don't notice it immediately and it changes your sound. So you go from room to room, moving from the place I learned to work to A&M, I took in my own loudspeakers that they were kind enough to let me place in a mastering room, and a lot of my own gear. So it's always scary making a change like that. Going from A&M to the first facility I built for myself, I fell in love with B&W loudspeakers and really bought them sight, you know, without having evaluated them. I knew that they were good speakers.
Well, then how did you fall in love with them if you hadn't evaluated them?
Good point. I'd heard them in places. I'd never worked on them. The you go to a hi-fi shop and you listen to them and you take your favorite CD and you go, oh, I can relate. The center is a little off center here. The vocal sounds this way. The sibilance is what it should be. So, and I've listened to a lot of speakers, believe me. They were the only ones in a store I could say, that's good.
Okay, but let's go back to the speakers. 40 years ago, there was a transition. There was something called the Auratone, which was one speaker meant to mimic the car dashboard. Then seemingly everybody went to the Yamaha NS10M, and they might take off the grill and put a little piece of tissue paper over the tweeter. But obviously, car radios have become more sophisticated and less important, but every mastering room you go to, everybody is using different speakers.
Right. It's a taste. You know, some people like ATCs. Some people like homemade speakers. You know, there are many facilities that incorporated a woofer here and a mid-range here and put them in big cabinets. It's really a taste choice.
Okay, let's go just to home audio for a second. You know, the big thing on home audio is these digital testers now. Okay, you buy something and it comes with a little microphone. Whether that's good or bad, that's not really my point. Are you so sophisticated that you could set up a room just by ear?
That's how I did my last room. And I think it's my best room yet. I mean, I don't think you could get a better place to listen to music. Loud, soft, direct, indirect, the back of the room, the front of the room. And I've worked with acousticians, George Oxburgh, namely, for decades now. And I brought him in just to help me, just to, you know, you're building a new room. You've got a lot of things on your plate. So it's good to have professional help there. But by and large, you set the room up to please yourself. You know, I've got good equipment. I built a phenomenal room. George designed the room. It's trapped properly. It's an incredibly
for
even
for the people
room.
Who don't know, what does trap mean?
It's contained. The low end's contained. It doesn't boom. It's natural. It decays naturally. It's not splashy. There are no reflections from left to right. You know, imagine a loudspeaker playing loud in a barn. That wouldn't be a good room. You put a loudspeaker in a room similar to what we have here. You can see there's sound dampening on the walls. It just breaks up reflected sound so that you can, you know, focus on the direct sound. In my case, the direct sound's coming out of the loudspeakers.
Okay. Now, there's been a big transition in the internet era. Back prior to the year 2000, there were a limited number of professional mastering engineers. Literally, you could count on less than five fingers people in Los Angeles, and there were people in New York. But suddenly, since the digital revolution, everybody thinks they're a mastering engineer.
There's a good amount of that.
Okay. And I know I'm trying to think of the right way to ask this question, but is basically all the newcomers, or any of them, any good?
There's always going to be somebody younger, hungrier, and better. So
I'm glad I asked that.
Whether or not they're discovered remains to be seen. But don't discount anybody that's young and trying hard.
Okay, let's go. There's Lander. Why don't you explain for the people who don't know what Lander is?
I'm not fluent in Lander, but to the best of my knowledge, Lander is a computer algorithm that looks at your sound, analyzes your sound. You say you want it to sound like XYZ. I think you can actually plug that criteria into the computer. It'll look at the frequencies, it'll look at the level, and it will make sonic adjustments to your track.
But let's to be over, I should have put it, Lander is essentially automated mastering.
Right. I think there are actually a couple of programs out there that are doing automated mastering. I think there's another unit in Florida. I don't really keep up with that
right,
stuff.
Right. Well, would any professional use one of those automatics? I mean, professional act. Would anybody use one of those services?
I would doubt it.
Okay. Let's go back to the beginning. Now, you've had quite a peripatetic life. You were born in Africa in a country that no longer exists.
Well, it exists. It's just changed its name.
Okay. So how many years did you live in what was then Rhodesia?
Well, I left Rhodesia at a very early age. The pattern was we left Rhodesia, moved back to Northern Europe as my parents were Northern European, British, and Danish. Realized that what they had experienced in Rhodesia was very different than being in Northern Europe.
Northern Europe where?
Denmark and England.
Okay.
And they sort of followed the sun, if you will. So living in Rhodesia, it's beautiful. It's like California. The climate's magnificent. You can grow anything. It's a marvelous place. California was in my parents' sights, and so we flew to.
Well, let's just go a little bit. Yeah. So you were in Rhodesia to what age?
Three and a half.
Okay, and then you moved to Northern Europe.
Correct. We floundered there for about a year, 6 months in England, 6 months in Denmark. We arrived in Los Angeles on my fifth birthday.
Okay. They were literally following the sun.
They were
literally. And that was their last destination.
They never left.
Okay, but they sent you different places.
I was sent to boarding school in England for my formative years.
So when did you start boarding school in England?
I started when I was 10 and a half. And I left England when I was, I think, just about 15, maybe just 15.
And was there anything good there?
It was everything good there.
Oh, really?
It was a great time to be in England from, 69 to 74. It was fantastic. We turned on to music, and I went to a very progressive boarding school, and one of my classmates got a cassette, which was a portable way of listening to music. It was mono, but he taped albums, and we would be out, in the fields just with music and hanging out with people. I mean, music was a really, really big part of my life.
And this boarding school was where relative to London?
It's 40 miles southwest of London.
Oh, so
Surrey.
Close.
Yeah, but
did you go to London, like?
Positively. London was an hour train ride from Frensham. And we'd get to London as often as we could. You have to remember, we're boarding school. We didn't have unlimited budgets. Once you're in London, cities cost money, and you could bum around London, and we did, and stayed, dropped in on people that we knew. But it was just a marvelous time to be in London. People, truly, think of Austin Powers and Carnaby Street, and that's really what it was like.
Let's go back. Your father was a butcher, right?
Correct.
So he moves to Los Angeles, and where does he go to work?
He went to work for a supermarket chain. And, my parents really didn't have much to begin with. We came to America having left Rhodesia with not a lot, because Rhodesia was in a downturn. So selling your house, it wasn't. It wasn't easy for them to literally uproot and come here. My father worked at a supermarket. My mother worked as, they referred to people like my mother in those days as secretaries.
Right. You can't say that anymore.
I know. But she worked for a company called the American Gem Society, which was a standard. It was a company put in place for standards in jewelry. She worked the balance of her work life there. My father ended up migrating from, one chain to the next, ultimately landing at a shop that I'm sure you remember, Jurgensen's, which was a very high-end grocery store, and was forced into an early retirement.
Okay, but couple of questions. If you're going to school in England during the winter, spending your summers in Los Angeles?
I would come back twice a year. I'd come back for the Christmas break, and I'd come back for summer. Now, the English school year is divided differently than America. You got a month off for Christmas, and you only got 7-8 weeks for summer.
Did you make any friends when you were in L.A. over the summer?
Well, I had my friends that were here, but England was a very, very changing experience. I left as a fairly straight child and came back with my eyes opened.
And you come back to L.A. and you go to high school in L.A.
I negotiated my way through high school. From boarding school, I had my eyes set on being in the music business.
How did that revelation occur?
There was, I think it's the third Yes album called Close to the Edge, and there's a picture on the back cover of Eddie Offord in front of a console. And, you know, we loved music. I saw that and I said, this is for me. This is what I want to do. So I finished high school.
You say you negotiated your way. What does that mean?
Because of the English education and LA Unified, there wasn't a way to assess where I really was in my education. So they brought in specialists from UCLA to evaluate me. And I was actually going to graduate when I was 15 and a half, but they couldn't allow it. So they forced me to stay an extra semester. I did the one semester. I then did summer school to take care of some required courses, government and history, U.S. government and history. And then my last semester, I had to take the the early course for the advanced course I had already taken just to fulfill. So I made an arrangement with the teacher that I wouldn't show up and I'd take the final. Meanwhile, I was working midnight to nine in grocery stores.
Okay, but then you do graduate. You have a dream of being in the music business. What's the first step and when?
I was working in a grocery store. I then decided I wanted to be in the music business and had to get out of that and had to pound the pavement. I found
A thought to go to college?
I went to college, JC, to really fill time because I was at loose ends and I had to get out of my parents' house because I couldn't be hanging out.
Right.
So I did that. I took some electrical engineering courses. But I pounded the pavement and got a job at a radio commercial duplicator. So I think it was J. Walter Thompson was a big ad agency, McDonald's. So literally, we stuffed A2 carts, which were like 8 tracks, except they were 30-second or one-minute spots. And from there, one of the guys I worked with he came to work there. He had just left what was Richard Perry's studio, which was Studio 55 on Melrose. I heard that and I thought, well, that's a door I've got to knock on. So I noticed that there was a studio across the street called, I think, Radio and Records or something. It's still there on Melrose. 55 is gone. I knocked on the door. The receptionist had been involved in a car accident, and the Carol Childs, who ran Richard's publishing company at that point, let anybody in because it was 74. It's a great time. And I waited, and the studio manager interviewed me and then called me back and started, you know, from the toilet up. And
okay, so the first job, I'm sure there was not a job description, but it'd be what?
Janitor. There was a job description.
Really? You were the janitor?
Truly.
You literally had the foot in the door.
Had the foot in the door, couldn't have been happier.
And that was the job of the guy who was working in the grocery store, janitor?
No. He wasn't working at the grocery store. He was working at AT&T.
That's what I meant to say.
I think that he had played his cards wrong and said he was qualified and he wasn't.
Ah.
So I knew that there was a void. So
okay, so tell the people, since it no longer exists, the history of Studio 55.
Studio 55 was, I think it was Decca, where Bing recorded White Christmas. We always said the ghost of Bing resided in the attic there. Howard Steele, who was Richard's engineer had owned it with, and Howard, by the way, was a part of a console manufacturer called Quantum. He had, you may remember the name Vanjie Carmichael. She did all the jingles. Mm-hmm. Howard was married to Carol. So Carol's mom, Vanjie, sort of funded this studio for Howard, and it just didn't happen for them. And somehow or another, Richard got involved, and part of the agreement was that Howard would be Richard's engineer, and Richard saw that as a benefit because he knew the room and all of that. And Richard developed the studio. He rebuilt the big control room A, made a beautiful studio out of it. Then there was B, which was a smaller room. Both had Quantum consoles. And it became an incredibly successful studio. Toto came from that studio. There was just a lot of great music made in those rooms.
Okay, so you start out as the janitor. How do you get out of the shithole?
Well, Howard was he was interested enough to ask me to come and assist him on some demos he was doing on a weekend session. So I'll never forget this. I knew nothing of what I was doing, and I mean nothing. I didn't know that you had to tell a microphone was in number 16 or any of that. So we get this whole thing going. And in those days, you ran a tape machine. And he says, okay, record. I didn't know how. So I just started assisting Howard. And then, you know, you just gain more and more experience. In those days, you could hang out in people's sessions and observe, and people weren't offended by that. And so I made myself useful. And
still cleaning up?
Still cleaning up, still gophering,
So, okay, if you're working there, theoretically you have janitorial hours. How much are you working there? Are you essentially living there?
I was essentially living there. I'll put some numbers in place for you. When you're in the union and you're a checker in a supermarket, which I was, you make incredibly good money. I left that job to go work for $100 a week. I worked over 80 hours a week and took home $76 on a paycheck and was thrilled to do it.
Okay, so what's the next step up the ladder there?
I started second engineering, then I started first engineering. And when you're a first, you're running the session, you're doing the vocals, you're tracking the drums, you know, whatever it is.
How long did it take to go from janitor to first engineering?
That's a good question. It wasn't that long, relatively speaking, maybe a year and a half, a couple of years. I remember my first real date was working with Earth, Wind, and Fire is the band without Maurice. We were doing... was it Denise Williams demos or something? It was like I was completely out of my league. But you know, you just wing it, and that's what I did. So from there, I got involved with a producer, Bob Estee, and we made a lot of disco music. He was part of Neil Bogart's camp, and Neil treated him really well. And over the course of making disco music, we would start mastering. And you couldn't really get the sound of what was on the tape on a phonograph record, which was the medium in those days. And there had to be a reason. So the people I was working with, we were trying to figure it out. And we discovered that there was a lathe, which is what you cut phonograph records on, that was made locally. It was a unique machine because with a phonograph lathe, the computer needs to know what it's going to cut before it cuts it, because it's turning a lead screw and moving a cutter head across the disc. This lathe didn't need that. So suddenly you could use a better tape machine. The next part of the equation were the cutting package, which was an Ortofon package. I'm using one today, actually. I do a lot of work with Dave Rawlings and Gillian Welch, and we're committing their catalog into vinyl. So the Ortofon could cut what no one else could cut. Very delicate system, but ended up hearing that Stevie Wonder was having some problems mastering Hotter Than July, and people I was working with had the wisdom to send him a Braille letter. And Steve was interested, and we cut a ref for him.
Okay, let's go a little bit slower. So you were working at Studio 55. Bob Esty and you have this problem with mastering. Do you then commit yourself, I'm on the mastering dream, or is this like a side project?
It's a side project. It's totally a side project. The lathe and the cutting amps were set up at the back room at 55. It was on a table. You know, we were just learning. But we knew there was something good about it.
Okay, so you had one of these lathes. You said it was made in Los Angeles. Did anybody else have one?
There were five in the world. One that was at the place that made it so that they could keep it running. Two went to a company called Future Disc that's now gone. And Precision had the other two.
Okay.
So they were finicky, delicate, and really a miracle that they went from day to day. So it was, again, it was a learn while you earn experience, ended up building Precision.
Well, before you get, but first you got a hold of Stevie Wonder before Precision?
No. Okay. Stevie came at Precision. Stevie,
okay, so you ended up building Precision. So you say, we're going down this path. We're committed.
We're committed. There were three partners in on it. One was an experienced mastering engineer that ended up not coming through in ways that should have. And so it was really, it fell on me.
So you were learning on the job.
By the seat of my pants. Fortunately, Richard started his record company at that point.
Planet Records.
Planet. And Michael Solomon, who I've just reacquainted with, put together one of the very first compilation records of punk bands. It was called Sharp Cuts. And, you know, we were all in the family, and Michael came to me, and, you know, the Plimsolls were on it. I don't remember who all the acts were on it, but Michael came to me and to master it. And I really didn't know what I was doing. But it sounded pretty good at the end of the day. The equipment wasn't so great, meaning the lathe. But, I mean, truthfully, there was a lot of tears for me on that because it just was frustrating knowing that the potential was there, but I just couldn't get it going right. And it took a while, but Michael worked with me. He brought me Mark Saffin's next. So I got a little education doing that. But the best education I got was your friend, Harold Bronson, who had Rhino Records.
But before we do that, this is before or after Stevie Wonder?
This is actually after Stevie.
So tell us the Stevie Wonder story.
Stevie was interested. There was a gentleman by the name of Arnie Acosta that was brought into Precision to help teach me to master. Arnie was really a gifted mastering engineer, and I mean a really gifted mastering engineer. And Arnie helped put that all together. Arnie, though, did not live in Los Angeles. He lived in San Luis Obispo. So he would commute down for 4 days a week, and we'd work. So the other 3 days in the week, because in those days, you know, it was a 7-day haul, it was me. And so I would be in there on the weekends just trying to figure it out. And, you know, slowly people would come. And
well, let's finish the story with Stevie Wonder, though.
Well, Steve came in. We mastered Hotter Than July. He's a critical customer. He really knows what he wants. I should say he didn't come in at that point, but we kept sending refs to him. And this, incidentally, was the infancy of digital audio. Stevie worked on these Sony systems called 1600s. And Sony built Steve a Braille editor for him and stuff like that. So it was a lot of pioneering on my part, Sony's part, Steve's part. It was really the Ortofon system that really spelled the difference, and Steve could hear that.
So he was ultimately happy that you were doing a better version.
Thrilled. We cut the parts for the world. We, you know, in those days, you cut lacquers. You'd cut two sets for Portugal, Spain, South Africa, you name it. We cut Stevie Wonder till the cows came home. You'd at the end of the day, there'd be a stack of boxes to be picked up by Motown and couriered off to the regions.
Okay, so then you do Stevie Wonder, and you were telling this story with Harold Bronson and other things.
Well, Steve sort of put Precision on the map.
Right.
Harold,
who was one of the co-founders of Rhino Records.
Correct. Harold, I don't know how Harold got to Precision, but he did. And this was really at the beginning of his reissue world. He was coming off the Wildman Fisher stuff.
Right.
And the Barnes and Barnes. And he struck a deal with Precision that we would work together for a rate. But meanwhile, you know, I'm doing Naz off off of the master tapes with Harold. And it was really, it was a great learning experience. I mean, Harold, who's a fantastic music fan, you know, he would have all the originals to reflect on and then look at what we were doing and he'd make corrections. And it was really it was a great vehicle for me to learn how to master.
Okay, and so go on.
I was going to say, when I was learning to master, it's about a 10-year process till I think you were okay to good. I mean, let's be real. You start something, you're never great at it unless you're, you know, gifted. And Harold worked with me through that, and I did a lot of work with Harold over many years, mastering his catalogs. And I think it made me better. It certainly gave Harold a good product to sell. And also now, because of the Stevie Wonder connection, those days people would look at album credits. And by the way, we were so late in the game on the Stevie Wonder credit, they had to put it on the actual disc label as opposed to in the artwork on the package. But they credited us, which was the main thing. So I started doing a lot of Solar Records, Gap Band, just a lot of really great music. And again, learning as I went along. I mean, it was in those days, reading the album art sort of helped your career tremendously.
So you weren't working it. You were waiting to pick up the phone.
Right. We were waiting for the phone to ring. I mean, that's I've never been good at selling myself. And it was just word of mouth that just kept.
Okay, so you have the Soul Records. Then how do you break into the Rock Records?
Well, as I'm transitioning out of engineering, I'm really full-time mastering. Jimmy, Iveen, and Shelly are coming to Los Angeles.
Just to be clear, that's Shelly Yakis. Shelly, his father was in the business, and Jimmy started out as Shelly's second, and then Shelly ended up working for him, right?
I think that's the way the story goes. But they were coming west because Jimmy was doing Stevie's first record, Stevie Nicks. And Shelly was staying in New York, finishing up, I think it was Damn the Torpedoes with Tom. Jimmy needed an engineer. I got thrown in for 2 weeks with Jimmy, which was just great. And we started tracking the Belladonna record. I was mastering, but needless to say, I wasn't swamped with mastering work, so I could do this work with Jimmy and Stevie Nicks. And it was time to do a single, Stop Dragging My Heart Around. By this time, Shelly had come in, and I had shown Shelly the studio and what we were doing. And I'm not sure where they mixed that. I think they may have mixed that in Goodnight, L.A. I don't really remember, but it wasn't mixed at 55. But Shelly and Jimmy gave me the shot at mastering that track. I'm fairly certain it had been mastered at the facility they were using up to that point. Once again, the Ortophone came through and put on the disc what was on the tape, and Jimmy and Shelly both heard that. So that was the beginning of a great run with Jimmy and Shelley, and which led through Jimmy's work with Tom, Stevie, obviously, and then Jimmy started his label, and I did a lot of the really fun stuff on Jimmy's label before he really got deep into the urban world. So I did a lot of work with him over many years. It was a good run.
So at what point does it turn where you've got not enough time to do everybody's looking for you?
You know, I never said no. So I can remember doing 3 albums in a day, which was unthinkable. But I was hungry. I was eager. I really loved what I was doing. And it was great. It was so...
Okay, but now let's say if you go to a regular recording studio, of which are limited in number these days, they're loaded with equipment. Okay, you go into a mastering room, there's a lot less equipment.
Well, yeah, because first of all, you're only dealing with 2 tracks. You're dealing with a stereo, so you don't need all the limiters and the preamps and the microphone, this, that, and the other. Excuse me. So it's, you know, I think I used the word chain a little earlier in this conversation. Mastering engineers like chains, and a chain is... I come in off the tape machine. I like this wire. I like these connectors. I mean, it gets really pretty minutiae. Like, I like to go into this piece of gear first. I like to have this piece of gear come in second. I like to have, and that's a great place to start. You may change it up, but you're using the same stuff all the time. It's not like, okay, we want to a funk distorted guitar sound. That all those types of pieces of gear don't really apply in mastering. Mastering is, you know, David Manley, who's a name a lot of people will know, built equipment. Now Ivana's running the company. But David really taught me a lot. He said, if you don't have a clean chain, you've got nothing. You can always make a dirty chain. And he's so right. You know, you don't need to turn something down to turn it up later in a chain. You have to figure out a series of equipment, of tools that you work with and that work for you. So the question was, why so little gear? Well, in my opinion, there aren't that many good-sounding equalizers. So... it took me 3 years to find the last piece of gear I wanted in an analog world, and it wasn't for lack of trying. So
now, if I remember correctly, you met David Manley because he came in and he said, I have special wire.
Right.
This wire. For those people, this is something that's debated in the stereo magazines ad infinitum. To what degree is wire important?
I'm going to take a very unusual position on this. If wire is making a big difference for you, you've got a big problem.
Okay, I believe that. But for someone like you or someone like Stevie Wonder, can you hear the difference in the wire?
You can if there's a problem. If you're working with gear that's really good, I'm not saying a piece of zip cord from a lamp is what you should be using, but whether if you're using a Mogami wire or a Belden wire or, you know, what are the, quote, studio standards, can you pick the difference? I'm not sure. This is a big problem in our audio world. People think they can pick the difference until they do a double blindfold, and then they're surprised. Stunned is the word I like to use.
Okay, so once you have your chain established, what are you actually working on each record? What are you changing on each record?
Well, it's on a case-by-case basis. Every song.
In terms of equipment.
Well, I'll talk about a project I'm in the middle of right now. I had probably not the right take on the project. I thought that they may want something that was a little more forward, commercial, loud, if you will. But that's not what they wanted. And so the producer I spoke to on Monday said, and we've worked a lot together, he said, it just seems like maybe the attack time on your compressor needs to be, you know, slower to let more of the transients through. Well, that to me meant there's, you know, I have my favorite pieces of gear that I like to use. I knew exactly what he was talking about. I said, no problem. I'll take that piece out. I'm only getting a dB out of it. And I'm just actually in the middle of finishing that record right now. But I completely understand what he was saying. I completely understand what the artist was saying. It made it too different than what they gave me. And so what they gave me was excellent to begin with. And so, you know, my task is to put a little frosting on this cake.
Okay, but generally speaking, I've certainly been in the studio with you where at one point you had a box that was basically, you know, push it up for a little of this sound, push it down for a little of that sound. Is that generally what you're doing?
Absolutely. But, you know, if just from a creative perspective, some people want to EQ before they compress. Some people want to EQ into a compressor and EQ afterwards too. So these are all choices. There's not a right or wrong. It's how you want to set up your workflow and how you or how I think I can achieve my best result for the criteria in front of me. Every tape that comes or every file now that comes in is different. And I mean, it's different. Some of them come in, they haven't used a limiter on the recording at all. I just did this record this is an indie thing, and it was incredibly great music. And the guy's really, really talented. He doesn't even know what a limiter is. I saw his files, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be hard work. And it really was hard work. But it was putting the right pieces to put the good color in place for him, preserve what was great that he presented, which was the fact that it was really dynamic. It was full of transients. But he also wanted it to compete, you know, in a modernish rock world. It's not the loudest record in the world, and it shouldn't be.
Well, that brings us to the loudness wars, which I really think of as being the 90s.
No, it's ongoing.
Still ongoing.
It never ends.
Okay, so explain what's going on there and how you address it.
People do their mixes. Mixers will mix, and at the last part of the process, they'll strap a plug-in, two plug-ins in to mimic a CD. That does two things. It makes it super loud, but it now becomes part of the sound that the artist hears. So whatever their choices are of tools to make it loud, I think become integrated into what really is the master. So somebody will come in with a file that's good to go. It takes a lot more knowledge to know good to go than it does to touch it. So it just depends. It's some of them come in so loud you can't do anything. You just literally can't do anything. Doesn't want to go through an analog chain. It doesn't want to go through a digital chain. It doesn't want to go through a plug-in chain. You try them all. And at the end of the day, you think, well, it's a little harsh on the high end, but this is part of the sound that everybody's married to. And they may hear it, they may not hear it, but if you change it, they for sure hear it.
Okay, but the way the customer would look at it is the loudness wars were based on making your record as loud as possible so it would jump out on radio.
No, go back a little further.
Okay.
So it would jump out on the jukebox.
Okay.
So we've all been in bars with jukeboxes and a great Motown track comes on and it's just loud and fun and boisterous. And then something that's a folk California, it's not as loud, and suddenly, you know, you can talk over it. So loudness wars started there, where you got noticed. If you got a loud, you know, they called them a hot track coming in on a jukebox, you heard it, made you want to go buy it. So that is translated for sure into radio and now streaming as well as CDs and the all-important feature called shuffle.
Meaning what?
When you put your library, your library on shuffle, and here comes, you know.
But based on an earlier part of the conversation with this normalization.
Well, there's an off switch for that, and okay. I suggest you use it.
Okay.
Most people don't dig deep enough to find it, but they all have an off switch.
Okay. So in other words, the loudness wars are forever.
Seem to be.
But the loudness wars were amplified both metaphorically and literally when we went to the CD because the CD could hold a whole bunch more stuff, right?
It wasn't a question of holding a bunch more stuff. There were tools that we will call brick wall limiters that would stop you from going over. So you could push it to the point of distortion, and we can all cite distorted records. Not gonna. But people found that sound pleasing. So what was unusual became usual. So now suddenly you've got a lot of really loud records out there. And again, the shuffle feature really makes an artist not want to be quiet. Artists are competitive in strange ways.
So this is as bad a problem as ever.
It's not improving.
Let's switch it to vinyl, okay? What do we know? Vinyl gets a lot of ink, even though literally the number of sales are small and a lot of people are paying them on crappy systems. You obviously started out in vinyl.
I'm still doing vinyl with Dave and Gil.
Okay, but let's start with raw sound, okay? Assuming, you know, can vinyl sound better than if it's a file to begin with, as opposed to be cutting on tape? Can a file sound better on vinyl than it will on a streaming or purchase service?
I think the answer here is if you enjoy it, it can sound better. I don't think there's a real answer. Technically, no, it can't. It's a bankrupt system. But it's very pleasing. I put on some of the phonograph records we've been cutting, and I've been selectively doing vinyl on some of the artists I've been working with. I don't want to cut, you know, bombastic stuff because we're using an Ortofon. It's very fragile, but it's incredibly pleasing. Do you get the same? If you didn't know what you were playing, if you could eliminate the ticks and the pops and the surface noise, would you find the same satisfaction off of a file? I think you would. You know, the surface noise adds something to it. I like the conversion of electrical to mechanical and then mechanical back to electrical. There's something that's good about it. But technically, no, it's not better.
Okay, so let's go back to stuff that was cut on tape to begin with. Are you going to hear it better on vinyl than you will on any digital system?
Vinyl is, let's just talk about vinyl for a second. Vinyl has really strict limitations, okay? The low end doesn't go as deep as subs do off of a file, and the high end is rolled off, but it's rolled off musically. So tape does similar things. Tape is not an exact image of what you've got. It's a color. It can be very slight. It can be very, very big. Back to Dave and Gil. They're complete analog people. We master their stuff off the Tube Studer. It sounds spectacular when we put it in vinyl. Their music doesn't have a lot of high-frequency component. There's air, there's dimension, there's space. If you're going to put in something that's done with files, that's all digital all the way through, comes in loud as shit, It can sound okay on vinyl, but I think it sounds better off the dig.
Okay, let me just ask you this, though. If you're mastering off the high-res file straight from Pro Tools, okay, to vinyl, is that going to be better than the commercially available file?
You know, I can't quantify better. If you like it, it's better. If you, you know, it's a taste.
Well, if we go back
first of all, you've got to have a great system to play back vinyl, okay? You can't put in a Crosley $99 USB turntable and think you've got something good, because you don't. So, no, that doesn't stand a chance. You come into my room, you've got a fancy turntable, you got a fancy preamp, you got some nice speakers, very clean path. Noise floor very low in the room, so you hear the rumble. You can hear all kinds of crazy details in the vinyl, but you'll also hear those in the file because they're not invented in the vinyl. You know, the vinyl's just a capture medium that, back to the electrical to mechanical to electrical, there's something very good about that.
Okay, I'll ponder that. What is the – so if I'm an act trying to develop, what's the best thing to send to you if you're working on it?
Something that you've mixed that you like and you say, I feel really good about this. So it doesn't matter what format it comes in, whether it comes in on a piece of tape or it comes in a high-res file or 44. It doesn't matter. The best thing to send me is something you like and are happy with. It's satisfying. So you have to work at your mix till you're happy. Don't come in with something that's limping and think you're going to be a thoroughbred racehorse.
So what is the futuring of the mastering world?
Well, it's I think it's very much a in the box future. I think that,
define that for those unfamiliar.
It's working with computers and plugins.
Okay.
I think there's always going to be room for what I'd call traditional mastering, an analog chain, fancy analog gear, great converters. But that's a special client too. Budgets come into this too, more than ever now. Somebody that wants to take the time to do a real full-on analog recording where they've got a great machine, fantastic tape. And you have to remember, they don't make tape so much anymore. So
right. You've
got good and bad batches. And so, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have a budget that you can work like that and you want to mix it down through your pristine Neve or SSL console and put it on a fantastic piece of quarter inch or half inch tape, it takes a lot of time. Time's money. It's
so if someone is doing that, and they're doing a full-on mastering, what would be the price for that?
For my services?
Yes.
I charge an hourly rate and then the goods. It gets expensive.
Okay, so today, when you're finished, what do you actually send to the manufacturer or to these varying outlets?
Well, we provide multiple file sources. So the MFIT. So we conform to Apple standards for the MFIT. We're an MFIT sanctioned studio. There's the digital, which is your Amazon. From the digitals, I think Amazon makes their 256 MP3.5s. And then there's the CD, which is getting less and less. And another thing I'm noticing is that we get less call for the super high res, the 96K 24 bit.
It's reducing.
Yeah, we see fewer requests for that.
Really?
Yeah, I think that I may not work in the genre of music. I think that that's maybe more jazz classical oriented than it ever, has been. But we used to provide those high res files for, I forget the name of the company in New York, the HD Tracks or something.
Right, HD Tracks. Okay, what about for a long time, especially in the CD era, which started in 1982 or so, remastered? What was going on there?
Well, in 1982, not a lot of good stuff.
Well, right.
But fast forward, I've been around long enough to have the privilege to do people's 25-year anniversary albums and stuff. So I just did the last, I did Monster and Out of Time for REM. And in those cases, REM's really into quality. We actually get the half-inch tapes from the vault, and I remaster them. I got to say, it's kind of a daunting task because I put on those old CDs, and they're incredibly good sounding. And it's, you know, it's always different, and different can be good, different can be bad. It just depends on who's judging.
But is it such that there's been improvements in technology such that a master like you can literally do things better?
Yeah, I mean, experience is a big contributing factor. I think that if you're dealing with somebody that works in the world I work in, nobody's really got second-rate anything. We've been around long enough to pick and choose what it is we want, and can use the tools to get out of the project what I'm looking for and hopefully the client is satisfied with.
So in a perfect world, if you could snap your fingers, what would you change about today's music industry?
I wish loudness wasn't such a factor. I like my loudness. I certainly get slagged by the people that like to finger people for making things loud. All of those people forget that somebody approved it. But my personal taste would be for music to come back a couple of notches because you never run out of volume on your volume control, but you sure run out of patience when it's too loud. You know, we had a car when our son came into this world, we got a mommy mobile. And it was interesting. The first click of volume you couldn't talk over with a modern CD.
Wow.
Wow is right.
Okay, but inherently, vinyl will be quieter?
Yo, vinyl, you know, you're at the limits of time and frequency. So to reproduce a 50-cycle wave in vinyl takes up space, physical space on the disc. So if you've got something that's got a robust low end, you're not going to get it super loud without overly compressing or compromising the audio in ways. It's not to say it can't be pleasing to do some of that, but that's vinyl has those types of limitations. You know, if you remember, there are numbers of your favorite records that are 9 tracks.
Right.
You know, maybe 34 minutes. You know, 17 minutes aside, 16, 18, whatever it happens to be, which is sort of an ideal time for a vinyl disc. When you get up into these 24-minute sides, they're okay because, you know, again, the level's not overly pushed. The problem is you start having signal-to-noise problems. I did Leonard Cohen's last record, and it was before I was cutting vinyl, and I remember saying to the guy that was cutting it that, could we hear it a half dB quieter? Because I thought it might sound a little better. And he said, well, you know, we can do that, but you're going to start noticing the surface noise. And he was so right. You know, he was just so right. So it's all a delicate balance. You know, audio is it's a funny thing to chase. It's sure a lot of fun. And
well, especially today, because younger generations are not into stereo like the boomers. So they're playing it back through earbuds and a lot of crappy systems.
Yeah, they are. I mean, that's the downfall of audio is that there's no resolution. You know, you're listening with such limited reproduction, you know, reproducers, meaning earbuds, even good headphones. There are very few good headphones. I know a lot of people take issue with that. I should say there are very few good affordable headphones.
Right.
And when the common denominator is the handheld device, i.e. your phone, you know, if it jumps on that and that makes you happy, great. And I'd like to make it jump on that and make you happy.
That's your job. You've been listening to Stephen Markison, mastering engineer extraordinaire, here on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. We've gotten technical, You know, I think a lot of people are intrigued. Some people are knowledgeable about this already. Other people can learn. I certainly learned a couple of things. Stephen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Till next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz.